my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Commissioner Maxwell. He is Commissioner of Education for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which gives him the responsibility for a worldwide religious enterprise. Many of you know something of the background of Commissioner Maxwell. May I just remind you of parts of it? He has been a teacher. He has been an administrator in higher education before his being Commissioner of Education for the Church. He was Executive Vice President of the University of Utah. He has also been active in political affairs. He was Chairman of the Utah Constitutional Revision Commission and has served in other ways in political organizations. He's been a missionary, served in the Canadian Mission. He is now, in addition to his assignment as Commissioner of Education of the Church, a regional representative of the Council of the Twelve Apostles. He is a writer. He has written four books. You may have read some or all of them. Generally, I would think, directed to all the members of the Church and yet with special interest for youth. I would say from my personal associations just two things that might help you know Brother Maxwell better in preparation for hearing him. First, I have been very much blessed by his personal touch. He cares about individuals. It's been my experience numbers of times to be talking to a young person who may be living in New Haven, Connecticut, or in California, or somewhere around the world, and I'll say, you know, who you really ought to talk to is Neil Maxwell. And I'm amazed at the number of times they say, well, I already have, or I'm about to see him, or he's been my friend. Brother Maxwell has a large number of young people whom he's cared for personally. You'll feel that as you listen to him. I think in addition, if you've read his writings and heard him speak, you know of the care with which he expresses things. I think at least I would give you my observation of that is that it is more than a literary gift, but rather he expresses things that come from the heart, and that therefore when you see the beauty of expression, you're seeing something of him himself. We're delighted to have him here. It's our pleasure to welcome Commissioner Maxwell.
Thank you very much, President Eyring. I'm delighted to make my way to this academic Eden, which you are. I think probably it's easy for you in your modesty and innocence to forget that you're in a special place. About one out of every 10,000 babies born in the world is born in a Latter-day Saint home, and only one out of every 2 million born have the privilege of being educated in an LDS institution. This is a special place, but you're special, and that's why it's here. And I commend to you the continued leadership of your president, whom I never tire of praising deservedly for the qualities he brings to his task and his great sense of stewardship. I wonder how many college presidents were in the classroom today as he was. And that tells you something you already know about him and this excellent faculty here. Now, brothers and sisters, if I can, in brevity and candor, it would be my desire to stretch you a little bit today in terms of a perception of yourself as prospective parents, which almost all of you are going to be, and to address myself to a theme that seems to me to grow out of the fact that you're special students and this is a special place. You can go to a number of colleges in America and get some courses on family relations, probably reasonably well done. But with the exception of this institution and BYU and Church College of Hawaii and LDS Business College, you will not be taught about the family as an eternal unit. You'll be taught about the family as a kind of temporary collection of individuals. And you will be taught here not only other different things, but about the way in which the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has a deep and pervasive commitment to the institution of the family that makes it unique in all the world. The assumptions on which we operate, brothers and sisters, about the nature of man and the nature of the universe are so different that they make all the difference in the world and all the difference in the worlds to come. And I'm grateful that the people here, your gifted faculty, understand that what Joseph Smith said is true, that if a man wishes to understand himself, he has to understand first the nature of God. There are these pivotal operating assumptions in the relationship between theology and identity that come to the fore in a college like Rick's. There's co-equal concern here, and there should be, with the secular world about the diets we have to have for our physical health. But we also say to a sick and undernourished world, brothers and sisters, there's a divine diet that's been prepared for the soul of man, prescribed for him, and that the primary source of succor for man is not to be government, not even to be a college, it's to be the family. In 1902, President Joseph F. Smith said that it is family life on which the government of the church is based and perpetuated. I simply don't know of any parallel commitment by any institution in the world to the family that equals that commitment. Because the prophets of the church have all drawn on the same divine well, their doctrines and teachings are the same. A seer not only sees farther, but he sees more deeply. He's able to see relationships between things and what really matters. The late President Harold B. Lee said, as you know, remember that the most important of the Lord's work that you will ever do will be the work that you do within the walls of your own home. Home teaching, bishoprics work, and other church duties are all important, but the most important work is in the walls of your own home. That wise, candid counsel about the comparative worth of things, brothers and sisters, came from the most able and remarkable administrator I have ever known. And it came in the context of President Lee's having spent much of his last few years fine-tuning the mechanism of the church. And yet it's significant in the last analysis that the summation of his counsel to us as members of the church focused again on the family and on the home. Our present prophet, Spencer W. Kimball, is one who tirelessly practices what James called pure religion undefiled, to visit the widows, the sick, and the fatherless. I know that because I have the privilege of being a neighbor. He lives in the same ward that I live in. And his is the kind of greatness that doesn't care much for the appearances of greatness. In his many acts of Christian service, and they are legion, it doesn't really occur to President Kimball, in his unusual modesty, that he has done anything special. Yet note, even in the midst of his particular penchant and pattern of great Christian service, what he says about this recurring theme of the family. President Kimball advises us, I like to compare the family home evening, family prayer, and other associated activities of the church for the saving of the family, when they're conscientiously carried out, with an umbrella. If the umbrella is not opened up, it is little more than a cane and can give little protection from the storms of nature. But when the umbrella is spread out, it makes the silken material taut. When the rain falls, it runs off. And when the snow falls, it slides off. And when the hail comes, it bounces off. And when the wind blows, it is diverted around the umbrella. End of quote. Brothers and sisters, we're at a point in human history when unfortunately it is no longer merely sprinkling. The rains have begun to fall. And at this very point in history, ironically, many umbrellas are being folded up and put away. I'm so grateful to belong to a church that does not allow itself to get caught up in the fads and fashions of a particular age or time. Samuel Callan rightly warned that any church that weds itself to the culture of the day will be a widow within each succeeding generation. Indeed, brothers and sisters, it is precisely because the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints resists the fads of a particular age that some of our critics see us as unresponsive. But the truth is that it is the very sensitivity of the church to what really matters that keeps the church from tumbling off the straight and narrow. It is the very responsiveness of the church, the very sensitivity of the church to the unchanging things and to revelation and to the things that really matter, which give us our best chance for increasing human happiness and reducing human misery, whether the issue pertains to family or any other key gospel teaching. We are living in a time, and the youth to whom I now address myself will carry it out, when the Lord will do what he said he would do, bring the church forth out of obscurity and out of the wilderness, to shine forth clear as the moon, fair as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners. The brightness of the church, brothers and sisters, is the combined illumination of the individuals who comprise its citizenry, setting the church apart from the dimness, the disarray, and the disorder of the world. The analogy of an army suggests to me the sense of organization, destination, direction, order, and unity. And the banners under which the army marches, an army which seeks no earthly kingdom, may well be the banners of belief, the unique doctrines to which church members are committed and which we must raise aloft. When pondering recently the definition of truth as given in the Doctrine and Covenants about things as they are, as they were, and as they are to come, I was led to read in Jacob these interlocking words: "For the Spirit speaketh the truth and lieth not, wherefore it speaketh of things as they really are, and of things as they really will be, plainly for the salvation of our souls." Note, brothers and sisters, the presence of that powerful adverb, really. The gospel of Jesus Christ and the church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints deal plainly with realities, things as they really are, things as they really will be. And one of the things that can really be an eternal thing is the family. Therefore, a real education must take into account the crucial knowledge that God has made available to us about things as they really are and things as they really will be, the kind of education for eternity about which President Kimball has spoken. Meanwhile, isn't it ironical that some of those in America and elsewhere who are most vigorous in taking the American family apart are also among those who are the first to complain because then the family does not work? Isn't it ironical that in an age when we are learning almost feverishly about what is most ecologically sound and what are the most efficient and economic ways to produce energy or protein in order to help other human beings, that we should be so incredibly blind because, like ancient Judah, we are looking beyond the mark when it comes to pursuing those processes which are best for the production of good human beings? The relative spiritual as well as the physiological efficiencies of systems are a justifiable concern. Beef cattle foraging on a range require about 20 pounds of food in order to produce 1 pound of gain. On the other hand, chickens with a good balanced diet produce 1 pound of gain for every 2 pounds of feed. One approach is many times more efficient than the other. And the same is true so far as human goodness is concerned. The social and spiritual sum of our political, educational, and economic institutions, when combined, are not usually sufficient to offset the deficits of a home that is defective. We have far too many human beings foraging on deficient homesteads, too many governmental programs which attempt abortively to substitute a less efficient system of helping humans than the home and the family. It is the home that we must rescue, repair, and sustain. Only when homes are full of truth and warmth and trust can our other institutions perform their tasks. And when too many homes are defective, then the deterioration becomes contagious. It affects our schools and our governments. If we are really concerned about the most economical way of achieving happiness for ourselves and for our fellow men, then we need to give attention to the development of those skills that are needed for successful family life. Otherwise, we'll always be investing dollars and time and hope in things that we are told will help people, but which really don't help very much. The wheel doesn't have to be reinvented, brothers and sisters. We don't have to reinvent the family. It is a divine institution which we need to protect and to preserve. There are so many statistics. Just the other night, I went through 6 books combining 10 years of research on family life in America. The message was plain, it was clear. And yet somehow the secular world doesn't seem to understand the generalizations that emerge. You may be acquainted with the character from mythology called Sisyphus, who is condemned to roll a huge boulder to the top of a mountain And as soon as he gets it to the top, it comes crashing back down, and he repeats the process endlessly, never quite making it to the top. This is the posture that many scholars unfortunately assume. They never quite understand the implications of their research, especially when it comes to the institution of the family. Whereas in the gospel of Jesus Christ, we're urged to protect that human streamlet from time of birth, to keep it pure, to give it identity and purity. The secular world seems to have an ironical tendency to want to build vast purification plants downstream to filter out the badness. Ironically, the secularists want to build these filtration plants downstream, but they can't really agree on what dirt is and what needs to come out. We understand, brothers and sisters, the nature of the human soul. We understand the nature of sin sufficiently well to know that the best way to preserve purity and identity is with a good beginning at the front end of life, and not with vast purification plants downstream. Frankly, while we need more research and information on the institution of the family, how much more research do we really need before we begin to accept the realities of how almost relentlessly parental patterns are projected into posterity? How much more research do we need with regard to the sources and the importance of self-esteem? I'm told that family size affects, in many cases, the development of deserved self-esteem, and that, ironically, large families seem to create a climate in which deserved self-esteem is facilitated, not small families. How much more research do we need before we begin to think about the deprivation of an individual in terms of what he has in his storehouse of self-esteem? Someday we'll become as concerned about what we have in the individual's storehouse of self-esteem as what we have in the granaries and in our fuel storage tanks. The individual's storehouse of self-esteem is a community resource. We have a direct stake in each other's level of self-esteem. How much more research do we need before the world can begin to understand that parents are pivotal, and before we begin to focus on the family without half-heartedness and without apology? What good does it do to reach a conclusion, as one major research project did recently, which found that, quote, family background has more influence than genes or environment on educational attainment, occupational status, and income? What good does it do to arrive at that kind of generalization if nothing is then done to assist the family? Of course there are some who, through no fault of their own, do not marry. Of course there are some, through no fault of their own, who experienced defective and broken homes. But these exceptions are not reasons for abandoning this remarkable resource, the family. The family is the tilt point for thousands of souls on this planet who could go either way, to alienation and anger on the one hand, or to sweetness and service on the other. We may find that it is true, even though sadly true, that those who do not believe in a God who is a loving parent and who is the father of the human family will also never be able to accept the eternal importance of the institution of the family, except as something that is socially and temporarily useful. The assumptions, brothers and sisters, in the gospel of Jesus Christ and the assumptions of the secular world about the nature of man and the nature of the universe are far, far apart. Little wonder we arrive at different conclusions, or that we have different priorities. How important, therefore, it is that we remain at our posts as members of the kingdom, as sentries over doctrines and teachings such as that concerning the family, even if the world, in its mistaken but sincere way, seems to be headed in an entirely different direction. The Latter-day Saint ought to understand, for instance, that the wars of tomorrow are this day being forged in the overheated families of today. How many dictators or assassins do we need to study in order to understand the consequences of distortion in the home? How many more examples do we need, in addition to the energy crisis, where the few control the resources needed by the many, before realizing that food and fiber are not the real challenges in the world? It is our selfishness, and it is the human delivery system that is defective. Where does one really learn how to share and to be selfless in the home? Where does one learn those skills that will be necessary to manage a system of human brotherhood? These tend to be learned in the home, if they're learned at all. Many citizens today, as you would know, get quite excited if they see a vast oil slick coming for a habitat of wildlife or a water resource, and we should. Isn't it interesting, however, that only the seers and the prophets seem able to see the approaching tide of sewage flowing out of parental permissiveness that is now in the process of engulfing so many? So few other voices get raised in alarm. Perhaps it is so because the ears of the secular world are attuned to the messages that come from the Paul Revere's, not the prophets. And there are so many Paul Revere's writing about, issuing so many prophecies and warnings that the crucial warnings that pertain to things spiritual are being drowned out. Isn't it interesting that at a time when we ought to know better about the limitations of what legislation can do to change human behavior, that some now vie for additional legal power rather than seeking for righteous influence? I say to you that women, for instance, may choose to ignore, they may even seek to rechannel the maternal instinct, but they cannot rise above it. Isn't it interesting now that the secular world directs our attention to many unmet needs, but how little is written or said about what is almost at plague proportions in America? I speak now of malfunctioning fathers. Fathers who so often leave their posts untended to do community chores that are so urgent, when in reality the things they leave undone at home end up being the problems that the community must then direct its attention to. I do not know any people who are fulfilled who spend any time talking about their need to be fulfilled. In fact, those whom I know and admire most, men and women, who have deep and abiding testimonies of the gospel of Jesus Christ, show some clear differences in their lifestyle and in their preferences, brothers and sisters, but on the things that matter, they are incredibly alike. I think one of the great advantages of being fulfilled is that one doesn't have to go on talking about the need to be fulfilled. And we can be fulfilled if we commit ourselves to the patterns of life that the gospel prescribes. How do we suppose we can rekindle a sense of patriotism in this country if, in fact, we don't have any sense of kinship one with another? And how can we have any sense of kinship for a vast conglomerate of men and women when we're losing our capacity to have kinship even within the family? And how can one have family without parents? Isn't it interesting that in a time when we want to demand increasing accountability from each other in America, that so many fail to realize that no deep-seated sense of accountability can exist without reference to absolute values and truths, such as the brotherhood of man? It isn't just that the gospel of Jesus Christ, brothers and sisters, contains all the correct principles for human conduct, but it's the way in which these principles are interwoven with each other. Secularism often seizes on a single true principle, and it elevates it above all other principles. But this is an act of isolation. It doesn't make that principle any less true. But when we isolate any true principle from all the other true principles, we make it monastic. We make it homeless. We make it vagrant. I know a lot of bright, able men and women in the world who live within the clean, well-lit prison of one principle. When we elevate any principle to the plane of religion, it's poor policy. Just as one person makes a poor church, one principle makes a poor religion. Principles can become prodigal too, as well as people, and can be estranged in a far country, and can be spent with little to show. Most every secular cause, and I've spent a good part of my life in the political world, most any secular cause about which I know anything at all usually focuses on a single principle or concern, but it is an act of isolation, not of correlation. It is the orthodox orchestration, brothers and sisters, of the principles in the gospel of Jesus Christ that is necessary for human happiness. You simply can't have a new moral geometry, as some are calling it, if the angles move and if the lines are fluid and the points are unfixed. The human consequences are so tragic. We need the anchor of the gospel and the everlasting values to give us the sense of purpose and direction. There are all kinds of Paul Revere's riding around today trying to get us very excited about this or that cause. The causes are often good. They want us to be righteously indignant, but they don't want to talk about righteousness. If our sense of righteous indignation doesn't rest on some divine moral absolutes, why should anyone pay any attention to us anyway? When he sees imperfection around him, the disciple of Jesus Christ sees such imperfections as an invitation to help. Others, when they see these imperfections, usually move and recoil in the direction of rejection of mankind or of life itself. As one wise writer observed, when a man hates himself, how much can he stomach the imperfections of society? Brothers and sisters, where better can we learn how to forgive, how to love, how to cope with our failures than at home? Strategically speaking, the choices are clear. It is family, or it is anarchy. Isn't it ironical that those who have been described as the new impuritans in their desire to vex religion, who deny the existence of Satan, somehow in their celebration of sensual things end up in the employ of the very adversary whose existence they scoff at? The great trap is sprung because Satan's most powerful desire is, quote, that all men might be miserable like unto himself. However few we may be, we must hold up to the world the true picture of mankind, things as they really are, and as they really are to come. We can best learn that we are a child of God by experiencing that kind of relationship and teaching in the home. We can best learn in the home that we are important, that we matter, and that there are at least some others who love us and who are concerned about us. Those who have not known love are more likely to have a special struggle accepting the existence of a God whose greatest attribute is his love, and on all of whose laws hang on the first two commandments, each of which deals with love. Those who have not known forgiveness are more apt to have difficulty forgiving others. Those who have never had to be accountable will have greater difficulty learning to be accountable themselves and are apt to be more shrill in their demands about the accountability of others. Those who have not been trusted will find it more difficult to trust. Those who have not earned deserved self-esteem will find it more difficult to esteem others. Those who have not known peace, both in their homes and in their souls, will find it more difficult to fashion a world in which there is peace, because conflict seems so normal. Those who do not know specifically what the conditions of righteousness are, as described by God, will find it more difficult to become righteously indignant at the human conditions that do cry out for change. Those who have not known the rigors of repentance and family life are less apt to be able to cope with the stress of change. Several years ago, an astute friend of mine, Dr. Jack Adamson, concluded a commencement address by recalling the Englishman John Milton's phrase that dealt with a legend that persisted then in England, how there would be an angel warrior by the name of St. Michael who would appear off the coast of Cornwall in England to save England from England's external menaces, chiefly Spain. Milton's counsel to his countrymen in that brilliant line of poetry I'm about to read to you was that England and the angel had for too long been looking seaward, for England was soon to be engulfed in a great civil war. Milton's poetic plea was, look homeward, angel, now, with pity and with compassion. That counsel is appropriate for Americans, for each of us here, in yet another sense. For too long, This nation has looked outside itself, beyond the home, in its effort to solve problems, in trying to improve human conditions. The message, brothers and sisters, of the poets as well as the prophets is, look homeward now and with compassion. I pray that in your families here, though they are substitute families, and in the families of which you will be a part in the years to come, that these will be special sanctuaries in which there will be trust and love and an understanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ. We cannot count on the external institutions to save us if we are not able to improve ourselves and the quality of life in our family. The prophets have spoken, and so have the poets. May God bless us with a sense of urgency that we might prepare ourselves and our homes to be that kind of special sanctuary, to be the locus of learning. And in the choice of your mates and in the decisions you make about your homes in those formative early years that will be upon you sooner than you know, that you will have the sense of being about your Father's business. Nothing you will do, as presently said, is as important as what you do in the families of which you are now a part and in the eternal families of which almost all of you will subsequently be a part. I like the lines from a brilliant Englishman of yesteryear who said, if you have not chosen the kingdom of God first, it will in the end make no difference what you have chosen instead. I believe that with all my heart. History is full of men and characters who are now lines on the pages of a book, whose accomplishments are often insignificant compared to what the eternal values and the scale of values we understand in the gospel would say is important. If we really believe, then we will prepare ourselves to choose the kingdom of God first and understand that the family is the basis of government in the kingdom here and now, and prepare ourselves as fathers and mothers for that task. And if I could leave one parting word of counsel, when you next write, or our next home, with your family of which you are an eternal part, take the time in an appropriate way to express specifically your love and appreciation to your parents. The time will surely come if you don't, when you would if you could, but they will no longer be there to hear you. May we have that sense of being prophet-led, for we are. President Kimball is a living prophet, a sweet, gentle, and yet powerful man, committed to the gospel of Jesus Christ totally. He has made his decision that the kingdom comes first. May that decision be our decision, and may we reinforce it by being effective in the mundane, unglamorous days of life that we spend in the family, where so much that really matters, if not most, happens. May God bless us to that end, I pray. In the name of Him whose church this is, Jesus Christ, amen.